here goes. Looks like I'm falling. Call me devil may care. I know it shouldn't be, but you know me, pal. I'll take a dare. Who knows, but this time I may be lucky. This may be on the square. Here goes, it's an adventure. Just call me devil may care. It seems as though I'm standing on top of something steep. I've got a crazy feeling of wanting to leave. You needn't say I'm foolish. You know advice is cheap.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. People that are only getting into the show recently, listening to this week and last week, may think we're a specialty show featuring cartoonists and old-timey music, so it's an odd quinky-dink, I guess. Do you want to let us know about that track we just listened to?
Yeah, that is Devil... let me see. It's Devil May Care, and I think the singer's name, I'm just checking, is Dick Todd, yes, who was called in his time the Canadian Bing Crosby.
Ah, I didn't even know it was CanCon. Look at that.
And that song has special meaning because I was listening to it the night my wife's water broke. So for me, it became the voice of my infant son.
Ah, well, it's good to have some kind of Canadian roots in there.
Yeah, it's a very atmospheric song.
It is. It's very nice. Just for folks listening, I guess I should mention who it is I'm yakking with. That is Michael Kupperman.
Kupperman,
I apologize.
That's all right.
And I guess your main book right now is the Volume 1, which means there will be more, of Tales Designed to Thrizzle, as well. You also had the book Snake and Bacon.
Yeah.
The Snake and Bacon Cabaret, I think it was.
Snake and Bacon's Cartoon Cabaret.
There we go. Which I unfortunately do not have, but it does exist.
Mm.
And you also have a Snake and Bacon cartoon you did for kind of...
Yeah, we did an animated pilot for the Cartoon Network.
There we go.
For Adult Swim, which they're not going to make a series of, but I'm quite proud of. And I think you can find it online. I think it's still on their website.
There we go.
If not, feel free to contact me via Twitter or Facebook, and I'll send you a link.
And yes, I should mention your very constant stream of Twittering.
Yeah. Well, I started using Twitter right after the baby was born. Or actually, the baby was born, and then I had to finish assembling the book, color about 30 pages, and do a 3D strip for Nickelodeon. And then, exhausted, I discovered Twitter. You know, and since I was sitting there all night anyway, you know, it full of nervous energy, it seemed like the perfect outlet.
And it is. It's, like I said, a stream of nonsensical madness. Like the Michael Jackson's nose was found on LaToya the other day.
Oh, that's a little, yeah, that was a little more topical than I normally do. And I try not to do celebrity humor too much or cruel humor.
There was a brief mention of Big Brother UK, which I appreciated.
Yeah, I've been watching it, although I haven't, I've not been watching for the past week or so. It shifts from being boring to interesting and back again.
Yeah, it's really boring right now. There was a good last night. There was a good fight, I will say.
I saw that online. It's funny because they brought in these new housemates to shake up the house, and there was a lot of tension and excitement for a few days, and then both the interesting people left abruptly, and now it's back to the same kind of petty squabbling.
Yeah. I'm sure everyone is listening, scratching their heads, but
yeah,
if you ever want to watch, you know, the American version of Big Brother, it's just, it's very American where everyone's kind of in this combat zone of power dynamics and power struggles. The British one, they're not allowed to discuss any of that, so it's all people trying to get along.
Yeah, it's interesting, so and they're not allowed to read, and they're not allowed to do anything. I've realized, actually, that the people who cook are lucky on that show, because cooking is at least something creative you can do, you know, that will take your mind off this. Mm-hmm. Well, basically, it's like a prison.
It is, and they treat you like you're in prison.
Yeah.
So, YouTube it, folks. Check out some odd clips of British people in pits of misery and despair, hoping for money.
You do see some stuff, yeah.
And they swear a lot, too, which I quite enjoy. They're not going to see that in the American one. Let's talk comics.
Okay.
We could talk about reality shows for an hour, and then no one will get anything out of this.
Yeah, I know.
What was your, your first interest in the comics? Because you don't strike me as a comic that's necessarily your scene is comics.
Yeah, I feel that way, too, kind of. I'm not sure where I exactly fit, but I'm not sure it's comics either. My first comics were probably Tintin and Asterix, and then a huge revelation was the Smithsonian Book of Newspaper Comics, mm-hmm. which is still around. And then seeing Crumb when I was about 12, that was a big shock. Really amazing. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I saw Zap and Raw. And those really were, you know, the main inspirations, I think.
Yeah. It's Crumb at 12 can be either enlightening or shocking.
Yeah. Well, it was Crumb's raunchiest, just filthiest, you know, most profoundly insane stuff.
Perfect.
Yeah. It was in an Arizona shopping mall bookstore. I'm still surprised it was there. It was such a filthy book.
Did your was it just something you saw in the store and just caught a glimpse of, or were you able to purchase it?
No, they would have never let me purchase it. It was I won't even describe what goes on, but it was some of his really filthy stuff from the early 70s. No, I was left alone though for a little while in the bookstore, and I did read some of the stories. So, yeah.
Now, did you go to art school, or what kind of school did you
go to art school, and then I went to art school for, fine art. I just didn't know what I wanted to do, and I exited art school still kind of not knowing what I wanted to do, because I felt like I didn't know who I was yet, you know.
Where did you go where was it that you went to art school?
School of Visual Arts.
Okay.
It was quite colorful in the 80s. Sam Henderson had this too. The dorms, they had no dorms, so you were housed in the YMCA on 34th Street, which they had two floors for the students, and then other floors were various transients or even some long-term residents. There was one floor that was notorious because of how it smelled. And there were glory holes in the upstairs bathrooms. It was quite an introduction to the city.
Did you grow up, was it Arizona you grew up in?
No, I grew up partly in England, but mostly in Connecticut.
Oh, okay. So definitely somewhat of a culture shock.
It was a big shock. It felt really liberating. Mm-hmm. You know? New York in the 80s was just a crazy place, and you know, the freedom was intoxicating.
Did you have any instructors at SVA that were cartoonists? Because I know, like...
No, I never took any cartoon or illustration classes. It wasn't until a few years after school that I started to really concentrate on that. I had some teachers I really liked, like Hannah Wilkie or Michael Goldberg, but, you know, the main thing that I was good at was drawing, so that's really what I spent most of my time doing.
Now, did you go to school with any other people that... are cartoon that did become cartoonists as well? Because I think Ted Stern went to, if I remember right, to SVA and did not take cartooning, but went into cartooning.
Yeah, I didn't really know anyone else up there who I know now who's a cartoonist. Kyle Baker was already very active in the school paper, and he already had that style of his, but I didn't know him until, you know, later. I didn't meet him until later.
So, post-school... what changed?
Post-school, well, you know, I had a succession of motley jobs, you know, and all the time drawing. And then I moved to Williamsburg in 89, and this guy named Kevin Pyle was starting a Xerox comic book called Hodags and Hodaddies, and it was a neighborhood kind of thing. He'd Xerox it, and then he'd laminate the covers at Time Warner, where he worked. And he was asking, you know, neighborhood artists to do stuff. It was very loose and experimental. So I did a few, and the reaction I got was so positive. Also, it was kind of a situation that doesn't come along very often, where I was in a building, and I knew a lot of people in the other apartments. There was, you know, a really loose feeling. One of them was Mark Newgarden, actually. I never got to know him well. But, so I'd do these comics, and I'd get an immediate reaction back, a little, like, performance, and it was very gratifying. So that's where it started.
Well, maybe quickly back to the art school. What was your fine art discipline of choice?
Sculpture. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What would be your sculptures at the time? Like, what?
They involved, I think I would... you know, find stuff in the garbage and then reshape it, basically, you know.
Found objects.
Yeah, found objects. I'd make kind of odd ersatz, not quite furniture, from them. I don't think I ever did any really good sculpture, and it kind of ran contrary to what my nature, you know, really is, which is to generally work small and be very self-contained.
Now, the strips you're doing in... Hodags and and Hodudes?
Hodags and Hodaddies.
Hodaddies.
Okay. I think it's surfer language. I'm still not quite sure.
Yeah, I'm not very jive to that lingo, yo. So that was your first kind of experience doing pseudo-cartooning, somewhat cartooning?
Yeah.
And was it just like panel gags?
It was abstract stuff. One of these days, I think I will put it all together for a book to kind of show how the abstract drawing drifted into comics. So there was a kind of continuity. My first comics are very abstract, and for a couple of years, they're not even rectangular. You know, they kind of... I would really improvise on the page, which can be great when it works out. But of course, you know, it's not really a practice you can keep up because there's so many misfires.
I find that really fascinating that you're talking about your work being abstract from a certain point, and then looking at your work now, it's very constructed.
Yeah, it's the direction it's taken. You know, I think I just I could have gone on and become a much more aesthetic cartoonist with the writing kind of in the background, you know, where the aesthetics take precedence. But I guess the direction really has been, at least for the last 10 years, to make, you know, the art carry the joke, you know, or work with the joke. So the aesthetics become, you know, a mechanism, not the whole thing.
I feel like now the jokes carry the art, looking at your current work. Is that a good way to put it?
Well, I mean, the important thing is that the joke and the conception of what's going on are conveyed, you know.
Now, when did you kind of, were you always into humor, or did that come along later?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, always into humor.
Now, do you consider yourself more of a humorist than a cartoonist, I guess?
I'm not sure what I am. I think we're in a difficult time because all the professions have become so stratified.
Yeah.
It's not easy to move from one to the other or have that freedom. It can be interesting. When I started out, I was doing a lot of black and white work. All my comics were black and white. I was doing black and white illustrations for the New York Press. And when I tried to get color illustration work, I was told, this is all black and white. How do we know you can do color? To which I'd reply, you have to let me try. Obviously I've done a lot of color work since then, but now there's a similar situation where, I'm a comic artist and I do get kind of attention from that, but not offers of work in other fields so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I've tried to make it kind of obvious. I have that, being a humorist is a huge part of who I am, but I still don't get that many writing offers, even though I'm trying.
That's interesting, because, looking at your, the poll quotes, you have, pretty active writers or people involved in comedy, including the introduction by Robert Smigel and Annie Richter and Conan O'Brien's lovely mention in his things that he loves. I use lovely and loves too many times there.
Sorry. Yeah, no, but yeah, Robert especially has been just fantastic.
And
Robert has given me some opportunities, actually. He is one guy who has, given me the chance to do some different things.
Why don't I play a quick song break,
okay. And
we'll get back in, and we'll talk specifically about the TV Funhouse.
Okay, which song are you going to play?
Buffalo Gals.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back. Okay. Ink Stud, CITR, 101.9 FM.
Outside, round the outside, round around the outside. Two buffalo boys go around the outside, round the outside, round the outside. Three buffalo boys go around the outside. Four buffalo boys go around the outside, round the outside, round the outside. Four buffalo boys go around the outside and don't see your partners.
CITR 101.9 FM, this is the Ink Stud Show. So folks know what's going on the Ink Studs. Next week, my guest will be Brad McKay, who is the editor or part guy, put together the lovely Doug Wright book, which is steeped in full Canadiana. We'll probably be talking with Nova Scotian accents, just to be appropriate towards the content. Not that Doug Wright is from Nova Scotia. And the following week will be Kate Beaton, speaking of Nova Scotia, actually. She'll be on another marvelously funny person, and she'll be actually in town a couple days after that for the Comics and Stories as well. That week, I think it's the 20th, the show, Brandon Graham and a whole bunch of other local talented Vancouver folks will be coming on the show to promote the events of Vancouver Comic Stories Comic Con. And I am right now yakking with funny man Michael Kupperman. That just took me back to the 80s.
Yes.
Who was that?
Oh, that was Malcolm McLaren.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, the man who developed the Sex Pistols during his mid-80s experimental New York phase.
Whatever happened to McLaren? Isn't he?
He's still around. I saw him on the Big Brother Celebrity Hijack last year, I think it was.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah, that was fun. That was how I discovered Russell Brand.
Oh, Russell Brand's pretty.
He's fantastic.
He is. He's outrageous.
Yeah,
which I appreciate. Malcolm McLaren also has some really interesting roots in his own kind of arty stuff before he got connected with the Pistols and fashion stuff.
So. Definitely, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah. With Miss Vivian Westwood, that was who he was with for years. And
that's right.
And they did some pretty interesting creations. And he was also a manager for the New York Dolls.
And Bow Wow Wow.
That's right. That was his pet project. That he put
and
together.
Then he followed up the album, which Buffalo Gals is on, with his opera, hip-hop kind of opera album. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't.
Yeah, he did versions of Madame Butterfly. And
That's right. That's right. Yeah. R. Kelly, take note.
it was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
It was.
We were just about before the Buffalo Gals, we were going to jump into the TV Funhouse.
Yes.
Cartoon you did. Or Smichael, giving you work in that, it's one of the things you did, I guess.
Well, the first thing I did was cartoons for the show TV Funhouse, which is on Comedy Central back in, I believe, early 2001. And that was an amazing experience, of course. I had never done animation before, and they had seen Snake and Bacon, him and Dino Stamatopoulos, the other producer. And so they wanted me to adapt cartoons from the book. So after, you know, the usual months of wrangling with the lawyers, I got to do two cartoons from Snake and Bacon for the TV Funhouse show. They're not online, unfortunately.
No?
No, the lawyers again. But I think there is a DVD out now of the TV Funhouse show. It's a wild ride, the whole thing. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I did
puppets,
not.
The puppet animals interacting with real animals. They all eat at a restaurant called Sames, where they eat themselves. Really out
It was
there.
Like when I one of the South Park DVDs, they had a little bonus intros where they're feeding pig bacon.
Yeah.
Making bacon with Macon?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it was. There'd be a cow eating cheeseburgers and a monkey eating monkey brains, etc.
Why does the monkey not get to eat something exciting? Or tasty. I don't know how good monkey brains would taste. I feel bad for the monkey. At least a cow gets a cheeseburger.
I'm not that curious, you know.
I'm sorry. And then, but later on you did Saturday Night Live.
And a couple of years ago, he called again and asked if I wanted to draw a Saturday Night Live TV Funhouse short. And it turned out to be, I think, his last season. He did one more cartoon after that, and then I think they're finished now, which is too bad. But, so we did, we developed together a Picasso, it was Einstein, having big boobs short.
Do you have a particular fixation with Einstein?
I like the character I've got going with him and Twain.
Yeah.
I feel very comfortable writing it. I don't know if I have so much of a fixation on him personally, but this was actually Robert's idea, although I contributed some to the writing. The central idea was Einstein had big boobs, so no one takes him seriously. I think actually Lenny Bruce had done something a little similar years and years earlier in his stand-up act where Einstein has a southern accent and no one takes him seriously. But the thing was, I went up to Marionetti Wachtenheim, who did the cartoons, and I had to draw this whole thing in 3 weeks, including about a minute and a half that was cut off, that was Paula Abdul traveling through time. It was just done all at high pressure with incredible amounts of revisions. But the thing was, when I adapted my own cartoons, that was just copying the drawings, basically. Robert was adamant about them not moving very much. So drawing a whole new animation, this was the first time I'd ever done it. And to be honest, I mean, I think it's a pretty good cartoon, but I always feel, you know, I could have done more. But as far as just learning the basics of what's involved in drawing a cartoon, it was invaluable, because it was just about 7 months later, we did the Snake and Bacon cartoon.
Mm-hmm. So it's a good learning project.
Yeah, by the time the Snake and Bacon cartoon came around, I had a much better idea of what I would have to do. To give you an idea, this Saturday Night Live one, until the first day I started working on it, I had never used a light box before.
Really?
Yeah.
I had so many people I know that's like...
central tool, I know.
Yeah, not even animation, just cartooning.
Yeah. I had never owned one before.
Wow. Do you use it now?
Yeah, obsessively. Oh, yes.
Where have you been all my life?
I have to keep getting faster. That's one of the main things. Part of the direction of my career, such as it is, has also been I just have to keep getting faster because, you know, the amounts of work I have to do, kind of increase.
More mouths to feed.
Well, yeah, there's that, definitely.
So maybe let's just jump into Thrizzle. Tell me a bit about where it came from and what was the idea behind it, and how much is it connected to the previous Snake and Bacon?
Well, Snake and Bacon is really me younger with a pen. I didn't own a computer actually until after I finished it, so it's just me and a pen. And then Thrizzle is a somewhat older me with a computer added. So, you know, and I'm trying in Thrizzle, it's not so much about the drawing, it's, you know, about giving a kind of kaleidoscopic feeling of a lot of different pieces that complement each other that may, you know, even give the feeling of being, having been done by different people.
I get it. It feels like to me, like it's kind of like a sensory overload. Like you can't read very much of it at once because you've got so much happening.
Right.
So many like little itty bitty things. If you tried reading it like a book.
Right.
It's pointless. You're just going to...
No, it's something you can kind of dip in and swim in and, you know, one of those books where you can start in the middle and work your ways to both sides and then you realize you've read it all.
Yeah. There's no central narrative we need to worry about.
No, there's no central narrative. There's no continuity, really. No. You know, it's you know, a reflection of the books I loved. I mean, the books that I loved when I was a kid were those Monty Python ones that I think Eric Idle was really responsible for, which were just beautifully designed and full of wonderful jokes. And, you know, those especially were the model. And then also, more recently, Viz Magazine, which I've loved in a different way.
Really?
I mean... it has gone downhill, and, you know, even at its best, it was never 100%, but when it was funny, it was exceptionally funny.
All right.
You know, and that kind of feeling of a sort of stew you can, you know, come into, and,
So, let's talk about some of the concepts, the key concepts, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
Tell me about the sex blimps.
I don't know. It's just a funny idea. I mean, you get these ideas, or maybe they're just two words, sex blimps, but then you get a little bit of a conceptual framework, and it's novel, and seems funny, and you haven't heard it before. So, you know, the idea that sex blimps and sex holes, you know, were because the law was very strict, except if you were, I can't remember how far it is, 15 feet above the ground or beneath it, something like that. So that idea, you know, there's a lot to do with.
Now, the art style, let's talk about the art style that you use for Thrizzle. What's the feeling you're going for?
Well, I mean, it really depends. I mean, there is some material in Thrizzle that still, for me, was about the drawing or about, you know, doing some interesting drawing. But then, you know, are you talking about the more common style that, you know, occurs a lot?
Yeah, like that kind of cardboardy, I don't know, it feels like they're stills from animation or something.
Yeah. Those come from earlier comics. I mean, I don't really look at mainstream comics these days.
Yeah.
And haven't for a while. But the older ones, you know, up through even to the 70s in some cases, you know, they have that intense stiffness and staginess and obviousness and, you know, bad postures and, you know, I mean, sometimes I do copy specific poses from those old comics because I think they're so funny. The, you know, like the man pumping his fists in the air with frustration, you know, those hyper-dramatic poses that they used to do. I just think that's the funniest language, kind of, this stiff comic book language. It's, everyone knows it. I mean, it's still around.
Yeah.
You know, so I just find that the funniest.
What were some of the Silver Age type things you've enjoyed personally?
Well, I just got a book of the Superman family. Those, of course, are just absolute gold.
Yeah.
I'm going to confess here that part of my recent Twain and Einstein adventures were lifted from a comic book I found called Super Cops. That was it was a comic book about the adventures of these two real New York City policemen. Kind of in the wake of Serpico, obviously, they saw themselves as also being kind of interesting renegade cops, even though they weren't whistleblowers and they weren't breaking the law. They were kind of mischievous. So they actually got a movie made. It starred Ron Liebman, and I can't remember who the other guy was, but they got a movie, and then they had a comic book, and they were also, I guess, selling watches. And I don't know where it went from there. I don't know if anything else ever happened.
You know, when you're selling watches, it's not a good thing.
Yeah. But they were starting this franchise, and the Super Cop comic book, which is hysterical, is part of that.
Not purposefully?
No. Kind of bizarre stories that don't, you know, don't make sense, especially for the more sophisticated readers of today who know so much about police procedures and what goes on. You know, they really do have adventures where they, for instance, decide to hide in a box on the back of a truck and wait for someone to steal them. Really. So, another really fascinating clump of comics is the, I believe it was Archie Comics did their own superhero line in the 60s.
Oh, like The Fly and...
Yeah, The Fly and The Fox and, who else? I think Brick Bradford was in there. Steel Sterling was definitely one.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do Marvel, but it's like they've conceptually described to themselves what a Marvel comic is. Big panels, lots of action, bold colors, and emotionally troubled heroes. So then they've put these ideas together, and they're all wrong. The panels are, you know, wrong. Compositions are bad. you know, everything looks terrible, and then the heroes are ridiculous. For instance, there's one, I think is the Web, who's henpecked. That's his, you know, big existential problem. Nagging wife.
I guess
they're just amazingly, yeah, they're just delightful.
I guess that fits in with some of your superheroes, like the Bittern.
Yes, the Bittern.
What is the Bittern's superpowers?
I don't think he actually had any. He just was a guy who decided to fight crime. I mean, if you go back to early comic books, that's the atmosphere, sort of. It's very nonsensical. You know, I can't sleep. I'm going to go out and fight crime, kind of.
Yeah, you had that in the in your cartoon for the Snake and Bacon, the Fruit of the Month Man.
Yes. Fruit of the Month Club Man.
Yeah,
that was... in the book, that sequence of superheroes goes on longer. And I have plenty more that are waiting for their stage. plenty more ridiculous superheroes. But my favorite one, I think, from the this Marvel, I think it was Mighty Comics line, is the Fox, and it starts with him in costume watching this girl go-go dance in a club, and people are saying, "Oh, the Fox, it's a sad sight. He just sits there night after night, pining after Jenny." Jenny apparently doesn't like him because she doesn't like the Fox. She likes the guy. But she doesn't like the costume, although she doesn't know it's the same person. So he sits there drinking, trying to make her like him. And that's your superhero. And then the gasser enters, this villain who sprays gas, and someone says, "It's the gasser. Let's hope this gas is non-toxic."
Oh, for the days of badly written... Oh, wait, there's still badly written superhero comics.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you look at, like, the Superman stuff, the crazy Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah.
Really ridiculous, beautifully drawn, though. And those had a huge audience, much, much bigger than today's, you know, grim, you know, hyper comic books.
Yeah. It's another world.
Well, I just think, you know, comics used to be fun. It seems rare to me these days that they're fun anymore. Daily comics is, you know...
even more sluggish to go through.
It's just painful. I mean, and, you know, daily comics used to have an audience like Dickens did. People who would wait every day, you know, obsessed to find out what was going to happen.
Is that something you're looking for, is just to have fun comics?
I think, yeah, that's a big part of it. Why not? I think that's part of the nature of the medium, actually.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of comics these days take themselves way too seriously. And there's this push to kind of get comics respect alongside literary works, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about.
Is, you know, and I kind of, I'm kind of the same in some aspects where I kind of look at comics as its own distinct entity and not to be confused with other entities and... Yeah, I could probably prattle on for far too long.
Well, I mean, I think that myself as an artist, I try to do things that are, you know, make use of the comics format. In other words, I think a lot of my work couldn't be anything else.
Yeah.
You know, it could only be comics. Whereas a lot of stuff I look at, it could be a film, it could be a novel, you know, it could be anything.
And that's a problem with a lot of stuff by some folks that are very enjoyed and respected, is that it's not really celebrating the medium as much. Like, there are folks like Chris Ware and Dan Clowes who really make use and, you know, use imagery and repeated imagery for a specific purpose. And then there's other folks, you know, like Tomine, I'm going to put out there, where it doesn't really, it's really well drawn.
Yeah.
But I can see this in a movie. I can see this in other things. I don't think it's necessarily a great comic within itself as embracing the factor that it is a comic.
Right, and the kind of narrative it's telling. I mean, I think people these days pay a lot of attention to the symbology of things and what they represent.
Yeah.
And I think that's gone too far, actually. I mean, people really respond to that before any other qualities, in a way. So,
I guess what's important is the gut reaction. What are you going to do with the comic? Are you going to sit down, read it, enjoy it, or are you going to analyze it and... If you can read and enjoy it and take it as a thing within itself, then that's most important.
Yeah, well, Yeah, I mean, there's an intellectual response to something, and then there's a, you know, just innate response, you know, an immediate response. And I think the second one is more what I'm interested in.
Yeah. I'm going to take a quick song break. And then we'll, when we get back, we'll jump more into the comics. And that's what we are. We're a comic show, isn't it? We'll be right back. Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM.
Oh, you are getting great place, boss. That is it. He was something going on.
What did he say? Now there's a guy in our quartet. Talks like no one I've heard yet. He mumbles, mumbles all the time. It's got no reason and it's got no rhyme.
Oh, you are really good.
What did he say? What did he say? What did he say? He said, bring something round, we'll have a ball today. What did he say?
It's truly feeling or something.
What did he say?
Anything.
What did he say? He said, you can't win no matter what number you play. Mumble, mumble, hear him go. Jumbo, jumbo, what a schmo. When he talks, he almost gargles. Seems like his chops are full of marbles.
Surely everything.
What did he say? What did he say? What did he say? He said, sing a little louder and we'll get more play.
And gentlemen, in case you don't know it, I am Mumble's interpreter. I see everything he does. I hear everything he says. Now you just sit back and stand by. I'm going to tell you all about it. Listen, now Mumble's had a crap game the other night. Now all the boys knew he had crooked dice. But when he took that third dice from out of his sleeve, he made nine the hard way. Ah! 3-3-3
Yoppity yoppity e-op.
What did they say?
E-opity opity e-op.
What did they say?
E-opity opity e-op.
What did they say? That's bebop talk. I guess the jive's okay.
Mr. Mumble.
Here we are.
What did he say?
I guess everybody around here knows what's going on. I hope we knew if they know this.
Mr. Mumbles, what did he say?
Yes. What did he say?
What did he say? If I ever sound like that on the radio, please turn me off.
I hope I haven't been mumbling. My wife accuses me of mumbling sometimes.
I get accused of that quite often outside of here. Maybe it's, I don't know. But I hope neither of us, have I been mumbling?
No. You've been very clear.
You have not been mumbling, so I think we're safe.
Good.
Tell me about Mr. Mumbles.
Oh, that is What Did He Say by the Deep River Boys. I should mention, I found both it and the other old single on this page. There's a man who's been digitizing all his 78 records and putting them online, and you can find them free for download. I don't have the web address with me, but if you just write my collection of 78s into Google, it'll be the first link you hit. And there are thousands, and they're just amazing. That was a tie-in to Dick Tracy.
Really?
Mumbles was a character.
Yes.
Who was later on played by Dustin Hoffman in the Warren Beatty version. But that was one of many cartoon tie-ins that are on this site, showing how popular they were back then. Dick Tracy, of course, is just an amazing, amazing achievement.
The website is 78records.cdbpdx.com.
Yes,
so there we go. It's a massive list of stuff. Wow.
Amazing. There's some Japanese and Greek stuff from the 30s and 40s. Lots of big band, jazz.
I'm sure Robert Crumb is all over it.
Odd, uncomfortable ethnic routines. All of it. Yeah.
Wonderment. I kind of get a feel with your stuff that there's a certain taste of the olden times.
Yeah, I know. I should get away from it. But I mean, I don't think I'm willfully antique, actually. I don't try to style my stuff so that it looks, you know, too antique.
Yeah, well, that's not the feeling. I'm getting more kind of less Seth, more Kim Deitch.
It's informed by the past, definitely. Yeah. And then, yeah, Kim is a friend, and his work just amazes me. He lent me this book recently called Winch. Have you heard of this?
No.
He's a ventriloquist, very, very popular in the from the 40s through the 60s. I'm sure a lot of people listening know who he is. he was one of the biggest ventriloquists, but this is his autobiography, self-published, and it also details his mental difficulties, which were considerable and very dramatic, and also his interest in medicine, which led him to develop in his dummy workshop the first artificial heart. For real.
What?
Yes. It's an amazing, amazing book. Unfortunately, it's not in print, and you can only find it on the internet for $300 and up.
That's when you rely on fabulous folks like Kim who have massive collections of odd, unusual things.
Yeah, I kept it a little too long, and he was certainly glad to get it back.
He was in Vancouver last summer, and I took him bookstore shopping, and I brought him to this one, and just I could see he was ready to spend all day there. I'm like,
oh,
I should not have done
it.
This.
Yeah.
And he had all these like crazy stacks of like kids weird books from like the turn of the century. So
Kim is just great.
Yeah, good stuff. Check out his work. Fantagraphics.com has lots, including Tales Designed to Thrizzle. Volume
One. Stories of old show business, ranging from early animation and movies to carny tales, and yeah, he's really great.
Now your work, it's more like the I'd say more like the, I don't know how to describe it, it's something like the prescription, I don't know, soda pop store oddities. I cannot speak English today.
The sensibility of the comic is really informed by sketch humor, which is, you know, something that I grew up with, obviously, and it meant a lot to me. And then, you know, the art is an odd kind of amalgamation of different things.
Did you get a lot of out of Chris Ware's current, not his most recent stuff, but his things where he does those novelty pages with the goods that you can buy? Because it seems like that's something that you're kind of edging on to.
Catalog. I don't really read much of his work, to be honest. I've looked at it stylistically, in some ways, you know, we stray into certain common areas, and I really respect what he does. It's quite amazing. But at the same time, narratively, it sort of leaves me cold.
That's kind of the point, I think, too.
Yeah, it's frustrating. It's a frustrating read.
What do you have for the future of Thrizzle?
Well, I'm going to try to have another issue out by the end of the year, and, you know, to keep them coming out as regularly as I can. So Volume 2 might be here within 2 years. We'll see. And they're going to be in color from now on. Doing the book, I felt that the color really makes them pop in a whole new way. So I think the cover price is only going to go up very, very slightly, 50 cents. Slightly higher in Canada, as the saying goes. But from now on, it will be in full color.
What was the original choice of doing the two tones?
Something that they suggested, and I jumped on it. I don't know. I'm always very self-critical of my own work, so I don't know if the two tones was really working. I'm not sure I felt like I took full advantage of it, really.
Yeah, I think it worked. I quite prefer the color, though. I find the color, it seems more like you have fun with it.
Once you've seen the color, I felt, that's the way to go. Definitely. You know, it increases the kind of kaleidoscope effect to me.
Now, earlier you were talking about the Dick Tracy with the mumbles, and Dick Tracy is something you touch up on a lot in this book.
Yeah, it is my favorite comic strip. With Popeye, maybe a close second.
you have such great strips that kind of remind of the Dick Tracys, the mentally ill gangsters, and the what was it, the ridiculous Dick Tracy characters?
Yeah, that
Dick
world.
Crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Including Dust in the Wind Face, Pacific Island Toilet Face.
Oh, man. Dust in the Wind Face, yeah. Mm-hmm. Second Place Face Place Face Man, I think.
Yeah, that
God,
one.
I'm trying to remember.
I can't even pronounce that one.
Yeah, different variations. In Sank and Megan, there were some earlier ones, Ham Hole, and Yeah, he had some amazing ones. There's one from the late 60s. Kim Deitch, actually, again, lent me a stack of pages he had clipped from 70 with a villain called The Pouch. The thing is that he was an intensely fat man, and he lost a lot of weight and was left with pouches and folds of skin all over his body. And he's turned the one in his throat into a receptacle with a zip. Bizarre. Bizarre, disturbing stuff. It's amazing
odd.
That Dick Tracy was on the newspaper pages, actually.
Well, he was insane.
It's so grotesque and so violent and, you know, extreme.
There's a great thing in an issue of Mineshaft where I think Crumb and Lynch go to his studio in Chicago and his crazy rants about hippies and stuff. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think he became rather right-wing at the end, is the impression I got. I mean, I came to Dick Tracy much later, mm-hmm. so I wasn't really that aware of it when he was alive.
Yeah.
Still. And, you know, Dick Tracy, after he left, kind of, who cares, really, I have to say.
Thanks, Warren Beatty.
Yeah. But, yeah, it got really bizarre. In the 60s, he had a kind of sci-fi angle, and he had it moon people and all this sci-fi gadgetry. And then kind of went back later and decided that was ridiculous and, you know, killed them off. Junior was married to Moon Maid, and she was killed in a car bombing.
That is severely ridiculous.
But you go back to the 40s, and the level of violence mm-hmm. and torture and fear is just unbelievable.
But it's kind of appropriate for Chicago, too, like what it's come out of.
Was Dick Tracy supposed to take place in Chicago?
No, but that's where he lived.
Oh, Chester Gould, yeah.
Yeah, as far as I know, if I'm right, someone beat me if I'm wrong.
I know not that much.
I'm pretty
sure
it
was
Chicago.
One of these days, I'm sure I'll find out, and I hope it's not too disappointing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Chicago with the massive amount of crime in the 30s and 20s, it's...
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's...
Yeah, and the atmosphere. I mean, that's the thing. I think Dick Tracy really kind of had more thrills and more bizarreness to it than really movies did at that time. I think cartoons at that time were leading the, you know, culture in some ways, at least in terms of luridness and display.
Yeah. Now, if only they had the same impact now.
Yeah, well, you know.
We'd see far more tights.
Yeah, I don't know. It obviously wouldn't work the same way. But
the whole world would be the family circus.
Yeah, but I feel that what does strike me about today's situation of comics is that they're kind of taking a following position.
Yeah.
You know, following movies and following, you know, serious art, those two poles.
I mean, if you go look at the example like San Diego, I mean, that's...
Yeah, there's no sense that comics, for their own sake, are really much.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying. But I love comics for themselves, and I think everyone listening should, too.
It's an amazing art form, and what I loved about it originally, and still do, is that, you know, it's such a democratic, simple thing. If you've got a pen and paper, you know, make one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reproduce it very cheaply.
That's true. Anyone can do it.
Anyone can do it. Anyone can see it, especially now.
Yeah, you know. Just look at webcomics.
Yeah.
There's a million and one.
Mm. There sure are. It's a world I don't know very much about.
Neither do I. I'm too busy watching Big Brother UK to watch to read webcomics.
I mean, I've met or discovered some of their work through Twitter, actually. This guy, Casey Green, I think is amazing. And John Keogh, beautiful style. Yeah, there's some very talented people doing them, obviously.
All these people I do not know.
Mm. Yeah. they're on Twitter. Casey Green is Chode Malma, and John Kyuk is Tom Selleck 69.
All right.
Yeah.
On that note,
yeah,
our hour is done.
Really? Oh, it's goodbye.
It is. If I had an exit song, it'd start playing up now.
Oh, didn't I have one song, or did we use them all up?
No, I was making a joke. You do have one more song. You just mean, you know, like kind of like that Muppet Show where they're at the stage singing.
Oh, making awkward banter. What's the last song?
The last song you requested, I don't have it written down in front of me.
I don't remember what it was either.
Another old-timey song.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, I think you had three old-timeys.
Huh, oh. Okay. No rap, I guess.
No Dr. Dre.
No, okay.
Yeah, we'll save that for another day, considering the name of your comic is Tales Designed to Thrizzle.
Yes.
We didn't even talk about rap.
No. I wasn't even thinking about that when I chose the title, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
It's,
call me out of touch.
I won't.
Anyhow, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Michael, and have a swell day.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
All right. Bye. And so that was Michael Kupperman. His book is Tales Designed to Thrizzle. Up next at 3:30 is The French Connection. I'm just going to lead us off, or finish us off with one of the last songs request. And then for folks listening in Vancouver, I'm going to play a little bit of... I've been doing this project online, the Inkstud's Cartoonist Mixtape. And so far I have mixtapes from Trevor Alexopoulos, Wayno, and Renee French. So I'm going to play a little bit of Wayno's up next. So CITR 101.9 FM, Inkstuds.
No man ever was nor ever will be like the man called Hank McCray. They can lock him up, but they can never, never stop him living up. Life had taught him long ago the simple fact he was on his own. Life had taught him not to count on anyone except himself alone. McCain, how to care for number one, how to take and never give. No one knows better than McCain that when all is said and done, that's the only way to live. No one knows better McCain, just how angry you can be when they cage you in with laws. No one knows better than McCain what it means to feel you're free when you know the